This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Climate change is carbon dioxide, right? Except at least 20% of global warming comes from methane. It is a wild west for methane emissions, with hardly any rules or controls out there. This super potent greenhouse gas is increasing every year. Methane more than doubled pre-industrial levels, warming the planet and helping kill millions by increased smog. New science led by Kathleen Marr suggests old ideas about methane can be dangerous. Dr. Kathleen Marr heads a key climate study group at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies. That's in Potsdam, Germany. Kathleen's doctorate in atmospheric chemistry is from the University of California, and she has worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. From Potsdam, Kathleen Marr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
In recent years, shocking heat waves struck many parts of the world, including my home in Western Canada. But now heat wave seems to become extreme heat months in Pakistan and India. Kathleen, is it possible rising methane is contributing to earlier than expected warming?
I have a couple aspects of answer to this question. One is, it's certainly clear that methane is one important contributor to the warming that we are already experiencing. So the latest IPCC report tells us that we are already at 1.1 degrees Celsius global warming above the pre-industrial average. Methane is certainly a contributor to that, at least to about 20% of the existing warming. I can't tell you from my research how much of the specific heat waves are coming from methane, and I guess I would also push back on the idea that this warming is earlier than expected. I think, you know, also maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, we thought about global warming as a problem of the future, but really global warming is here and different parts of the world are experiencing it with different intensity. But as I mentioned, we're already 1.1 degrees of warming. So I'm not sure that these heat waves are necessarily unexpected.
Well, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change includes methane. In the new paper, you and your co-authors write, quote, "The UNFCCC framework neglects the impacts of CH4, which is methane, has on near-term climate." Could you explain that, please?
Methane is a greenhouse gas, and it's covered under the UNFCCC, which is the UN Climate Convention. The latest big agreement was the Paris Agreement, which many of you have heard of. And among the greenhouse gases, CO2 is the most prominent, also the most important. And all the other greenhouse gases, their impact on warming gets compared to the impact of CO2, and specifically looking at how much warming it causes over 100 years. So CO2 is very long-lived in the atmosphere, which is one of the things that makes it very challenging, because when we stop emitting CO2 today, the CO2 we emitted yesterday, like even if we stopped all our CO2 emissions magically, the CO2 we emitted yesterday, a huge portion would still be in the atmosphere 100 years from now. So this is one of the reasons that makes climate change as a problem so intractable. The thing about methane is, in comparison to CO2, if you look at this 100-year warming, they use a metric called global warming potential over 100 years, and methane on a ton per ton basis is about 30 times more potent of a warmer than CO2. So as a molecule, methane is a strong absorber. It leads to a lot of warming. But the thing about methane that's different from CO2 is that it gets removed from the atmosphere much more quickly, primarily through chemical processes. But that means its lifetime is on the order of 10 to 12 years. That means it gets removed from the atmosphere much more quickly. So if we look at short time frames, if we only look at the warming impact over 20 years, for instance, then methane is about 80 times more powerful of a warmer than CO2. So going back to the UNFCCC with your question, everything under the UNFCCC is kind of uses this GWP 100, this 100-year time frame as the metric. But that means that methane's impact on near-term warming is overlooked, neglected, underrepresented.
We all want to know, where is the new methane coming from? A scientist like you and Nisbet, who was on our program, he found the largest source of increasing methane are tropical bogs. But citing a 2020 study led by another guest, Rob Jackson, you write, a new study concludes that the recent growth is due in roughly equal parts to emissions from fossil fuel sources and the combined emissions from agricultural and waste sources, end quote. So the methane budget's not settled in science?
That is my perception. So that is not my particular area of expertise. I read a lot of these studies. So methane budget means, like, if you imagine the amount of methane in the atmosphere is like your bank account. The how much money is in your bank account is a balance between how much is going in the case of methane, it would be emissions, and how much is being taken out. And in the case of methane, that's chemical decomposition primarily. But that's what it means when people are trying to figure out what the methane budget is. It's not so easy to measure / calculate. There's different methods of doing that, and the different methods come up with some different answers. So I did cite this study by Jackson, which is quite recent, but I think it's not completely resolved as a matter of scientific inquiry where exactly the primary sources of the methane increases are coming from.
One thing the science community does agree on, the worrying rise in methane is not coming from the Arctic. Is that a surprise?
I don't think so. To me, it's not a surprise. I know there's concern about permafrost melting in the Arctic, for instance, as a source of methane. But when I read the scientific studies in more detail about that, first of all, it's not expected so soon. It would be more relevant on like a 50-year time frame. And the other thing about permafrost is that when it melts, you create methane kind of under the earth, under the permafrost, but a lot of it becomes CO2 by the time it's emitted in the atmosphere, which doesn't mean it's less of a climate problem. It's the permafrost melting will lead to methane, but also CO2 emissions. So for me, it's not a surprise that methane is not coming from the Arctic.
Jackson finds we're heading towards the hottest scenario envisioned by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is 4.3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. What does your study group expect for methane levels by 2050?
So I have to say here that we are not the ones making these sort of projections. So the study that I recently published on methane, it's really kind of an interdisciplinary synthesis study where we're synthesizing the many different aspects of the natural science together with a view on the governance, so the social and political science of methane. So unfortunately, I'm the wrong expert to ask about that one.
Okay. And your paper finds methane heats the planet in so many ways, 4 by my count. Kathleen, talk to us about the 3 continuing impacts as methane breaks down.
Methane, when it ends up in the atmosphere, gets broken down by chemical reactions. So the chain of chemical reactions is usually started by what's known as the hydroxyl radical, OH. And then you get these byproducts, you get these intermediate products as methane is broken down. And one important one is tropospheric ozone. Ozone itself is also a climate warmer. It warms the atmosphere, so you have a warming impact from one of methane's degradation products, and perhaps even more importantly, tropospheric ozone is an air pollutant. So when you breathe it, it irritates your lungs, it causes asthma as well as other health problems associated with COPD, for instance. The end product of methane oxidation is actually CO2. So there's a little bit of a 2-for-1 there. So when this chemistry, this chain of chemistry is finished, we end up with CO2. We know CO2 is also warming. And another small byproduct of methane oxidation is water in the stratosphere, stratospheric water vapor, that also has a warming impact. Going back to tropospheric ozone. So I mentioned the health effects of tropospheric ozone, but that actually has further effects. Ozone is free radical. Back, I don't know, in the 90s, this was a popular term for things that were harmful, but basically tropospheric ozone is very reactive. So it not only reacts in your lungs, but it damages plants and causes crop losses. So there's estimates of the damages to crops that are due to ozone. And there's a good indication that it reduces the land carbon storage. So you think of forests, for instance, as absorbing carbon. There's a potential for damage by ozone to then reduce, basically harm the plants and reduce their ability to uptake carbon. Although that's a very complicated, there's very complicated relationships there. So that piece is associated with more scientific uncertainty.
So these new additional gases from the breakdown and the impacts on the possible buffering ability of plant life, those things aren't really and can't really be included in just talking about a carbon dioxide equivalent as the UN body tends to do.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly the point of the article I just wrote. So when we treat methane as simply a CO2 equivalent, multiplied by a factor of 30, we're missing some pieces. And, of course, the most important thing is that we emit less methane, that we practically stop emitting methane, regardless of why or, you know, how the legal structure is. But, for instance, you know, if you think about carbon markets or carbon pricing schemes, there are a few. Many that exist don't include methane, and the ones that do are also at the price based on its CO2 equivalent. But, you know, for instance, if you wanted to take into account the strong near-term warming impact or any of the other impacts, it's not included in that sort of scheme.
You are an atmospheric chemist, Kathleen Maher. Do we know if climate change itself will create more methane emissions?
We have some ideas, but there's a lot of scientific uncertainty. So basically, it comes down to the question of natural methane sources. So, of course, the anthropogenic sources are under our control. Let's say, for instance, fossil fuels, oil and gas. The other important sources are waste management, and also agriculture. But as the Earth gets warmer, what happens to the natural sources? So, for instance, wetlands are the most important natural source of methane right now. And how much methane they emit is determined by many factors, including the soil temperature, water table depth, vegetation cover and composition. These are all things that are affected, will be affected by climate change, but it's very difficult to say exactly how that's going to have an effect on methane emissions. But basically, the scientific understanding right now is that it will lead to more methane emissions under climate change from wetlands, for instance, but it's pretty hard to quantify. Also, this permafrost melting, for instance, I mentioned before, it's possible that will lead to significantly increased methane emissions, but we don't really know when or how much. But on the whole, it doesn't look so good that more climate change means more natural methane emissions. It's probably the case.
I gather methane itself is not a poisonous gas for us, but health concerns do emerge from methane. Could you talk to us about how that works?
Yeah, so from an air pollution perspective, things are usually considered air pollutants if you breathe it in, and then breathing it in has a harmful effect. And so for this reason, methane has never really been categorized as an air pollutant because itself, you just breathe it in and breathe it out. It's inert. But it's a very important precursor or source of tropospheric ozone. So when methane sticks around in the atmosphere for a little while, it begins to react, and then you create ozone. And as mentioned before, ozone is then a serious air pollution and health problem. It damages the lungs. It's associated with asthma, COPD, and other lung diseases. And in fact, you know, there's other precursors to tropospheric ozone, but as air pollution controls improve on the whole globally, methane is becoming a more and more important the source of tropospheric ozone. So it's going to become important to address it in an air pollution context as well.
There are some regulatory things going on. First of all, can big companies or countries excuse fossil fuel emissions at home by purchasing an offset credit related to methane as they can for carbon dioxide?
Yes. For instance, if you think internationally, it would be possible for a company to say, okay, it's too expensive for me to reduce my own carbon emissions, so I'm going to invest in and essentially pay for this project in a different country, and let's say this project captures methane from landfills, then yes, that can go on their accounting sheet. It's always a question of who, accounting of carbon is very tricky. It's always a question of who's counting what system it is. But under the UNFCCC, these projects are allowed. As we get to a future very soon where we really shouldn't be emitting, using fossil fuels at all, like, this becomes problematic. We just have to stop emitting. But this is possible, yeah.
From Potsdam, Germany, you are listening to scientist Kathleen Marr on the new understanding of methane. Why is it building in the atmosphere? How much is it heating planet Earth? This is Radio EcoShock, blasting around the world from ecoshock.org.
There are annual meetings about the convention of the parties to agreements on climate change. We had COP26 in Scotland. Is there an international body charged with regulating and reducing air pollution?
The short answer is no. Well, there's no treaty. So the UNFCCC is a treaty, and then under this treaty, there's all these meetings, and it produced the Paris Agreement, for instance. There's no treaty covering air pollution globally. UN Environment, the UNEP Environment Program, or UNEP, is increasingly doing more on air pollution, and falls under them as a UN agency, at least because it's an environmental issue. But there's increasing attention to air pollution within UNEP, and they have some resolutions about air pollution. But there's no global treaty now.
Do we really know how much methane each country is putting into the atmosphere?
I would say yes, but with what precision and accuracy, it gets a little bit fuzzy. So in terms of emissions, each country is required to submit reports to the UNFCCC about their emissions, including methane emissions. They do that for the most part. There's also, besides self-reporting, there's scientific methodologies to, make independent estimates. People do that. That doesn't mean there aren't uncertainties. And right now, the two biggest uncertainties with kind of political ramifications are, one, particularly in the oil and gas sector, there have been studies that show, basically using infrared cameras to detect methane leaks, and studies that show, okay, the emissions that are being reported are way too low, or that there's way more leaks than companies are either aware of or reporting. So that's a sort of uncertainty. And as well, from agriculture, the methodologies for estimating emissions are less advanced, let's say. There has been some progress on this front. There's a new initiative under the UN called IMEO, the International Methane Emissions Observatory. So fundamentally, they're going to be compiling data from many sources to calculate methane emissions, but one of the important sources is satellite data, so there has been significant advances in the science on being able to detect methane emissions from satellites. So that information is getting better and better.
In most countries, I could drill into the ground and release lots of methane without breaking any laws, national or international. In fact, most gas fracking operations vent new wells with methane for a couple of weeks before they capture the natural gas. That's why I called it a Wild West situation. This gas, which is so dangerous to both climate and human health, how can it remain free to dump into the air in any amounts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of the answer, at least, is that it's an example of the technology of fracking then outpacing the regulation. And then in the U.S., for instance, depending on who was in the government, also then not very much appetite for regulation. I can say, so I worked at the EPA for several years, but that was now 10 years ago, so I'm less up to date than I used to be. But, you know, methane and CO2 are covered under the United States Clean Air Act, but specific regulations, not too many have been passed. So, yeah, that's the situation. And on an international level, it's like at the UNFCCC process, it's about countries reporting their total emissions and then also reducing their total emissions and setting goals, but at the international level.
So while we await international action, there are some voluntary efforts which you talk about in your paper. They seem like more or less self-regulation by oil and gas companies in one case. Considering the danger, they don't sound like much. Your thoughts?
I guess I have a slightly more positive view. Focusing on the international level, which is also where my research focuses mostly, I mean, we have the Paris Agreement, there's legally binding aspects of it, but fundamentally it's about, there is no international environmental police that's going to enact a punishment if a country doesn't meet their climate targets. So even, let's say, the formal binding agreements, some aspects have a voluntary character as well. For instance, so one initiative at COP26, the Global Methane Pledge, was launched. This pledge is to, now let me look at the numbers, I think it's to reduce global methane emissions by 30% by 2030. And I think it helps to have political attention, momentum. Of course, getting then implementation on the ground is always the tricky part. So, yeah, I guess I wouldn't be too... I have some hope that, let's say, the voluntary partnerships and voluntary initiatives really can achieve something. In the case of oil and gas, you mentioned, you know, voluntary efforts on their part. One source of optimism, at least for some, is that, you know, the oil and gas companies do actually should have a self-incentive to capture their methane because it's their product. So if they leak less, they can sell more and make more money. So on the one hand, it should be a no-brainer, and this should be something that's a solution that's easy to implement because they are on board. So that's where I'm coming from on that end.
So here we are, somewhat still in the dark about one of the biggest threats growing in the atmosphere in methane, and time is short. Is it too late for emergency action to slash methane emissions by humans?
I think when in these conversations about climate, questions about is it too late, they almost become philosophical questions. So, no, the answer is, you know, if we want to meet the Paris goal of staying within 1.5 degrees of warming, a lot has to happen very soon. And it's technically possible, whether it's politically possible is more doubtful, but it's not that, you know, the laws of physics are preventing us, or also that, you know, we're lacking the technologies to do this. But of course, keeping global warming under 1.5 degrees is looking less and less likely. I also come from the perspective that it's actually never too late. So we have these Paris goals. We want to keep global warming well below 2 degrees, and ideally below 1.5 degrees. But, you know, if we reach 2.1 degrees of warming, it doesn't mean we should give up, because 2.1 degrees of warming is way better than 2.5 degrees, and it's definitely way better than 4 degrees of warming. So basically, the less warming we have, the better. So late action is better than no action. But, yeah, to reach our Paris goals, we need a lot of action now, and certainly more than we've seen to date.
What are you working on next?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the very near future, I'm traveling to Bonn for what's called the Intersessionals. It's the preparatory meeting for the big UN climate conference, which will be in Egypt at the end of the year. I have an interest in kind of the meta level of what you might call science policy interface. So how can scientists and policymakers best interact? What's fruitful there? And really thinking about, you know, information exchange, that it's not about one-way knowledge transfer from science to policy. It's much more complex than that. So that's one of the things I'm working on, and also thinking about on a practical level, assessing needs at the science policy interface on methane, with the idea to maybe launch some sort of science policy platform. But these are ideas rather than concrete plans at the moment. Other than that, my group at the ISS, Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Germany, we have kind of a dual focus. One is really engaging in political processes, including the UNFCCC, but also the Climate and Clean Air Coalition, which is also a coalition that's, among other things, trying to advance and accelerate action on methane, and combining with that with our interdisciplinary research, combining physical sciences, but also then social and political science.
We really need that combination of social and political science with raw science, because that's what it's going to take. We have been speaking with Dr. Kathleen Marr. She leads the new paper, Beyond CO2 Equivalents, the Impacts of Methane on Climate, Ecosystems, and Health. That is open access. It's free for you to read, listeners. And you can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kathleen, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.